We continue in the life of David tonight, beginning in chapter 27. David is still, of course, running from King Saul. And as I've mentioned, as we've gone through, I believe that what David is going through is something that God has purposely brought about and in allowing in David's life to refine him, to develop character, to develop depth, to strengthen him in the inner man. I believe God will allow us to go through hard times because he wants to strengthen our inner person. He wants us to develop depth of character. Now, we want shortcuts. We want instant maturity, like instant cake and instant pie and instant candy, but these things don't work in the spiritual realm. It only comes about through processes of learning to trust God through the difficult places of life. Tonight we come across one of the episodes in the life of David where he really hit a low spot. Seems like everything in life was just totally falling apart for David. We find that David turned to the Lord at that time and he encouraged himself in God. And it was at that point then everything began to turn around in the life of David. Now in chapter 26, David had just spared Saul's life for the second time. But it opens in chapter 27, verse 1, and David said in his heart, "I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. So there is nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape unto the land of the Philistines. And Saul shall despair of me to seek me any more in any coast of Israel, so I will escape out of his hand." You see, David is pretty discouraged. He's looking on the negative side. And all he can think of is, I know one day I will perish at the hand of Saul. It's a negative confession, David. Don't you know that what you say is what you get? But David did not perish at the hand of Saul. But all he can see is his difficulties. All he can see is his problems. Now, beginning at this point in David's life, I believe you can draw an analogy to the Christian life today. And that analogy is this, that at this point, though David is faced with this hardship, instead of turning to God, instead of waiting on God, instead of trusting God, David resorts to his own human understanding. He resorts to the so-called arm of the flesh, to his own ability, and he gets himself in a tight spot. God miraculously delivers David, but instead of him seeking the Lord, you don't read anything about him inquiring of the Lord, where should he go? He didn't say, "Lord, lead me," and the Lord said, "Go to the Philistines." He just said, "I know I'm going to die. I might as well go to the Philistines." And so you might say David is backsliding in a sense right now. And a lot of good Bible teachers agree with that. They feel that David is making a mistake in going into the area of the Philistines. The Philistines were the enemies of God. And David had no place hanging out there. You say, well, what is he supposed to do? He's kicked out of Israel, you know, no place to go, so he goes with the enemies. Well, in a sense, that's true, but there were areas that David could have gone and hid it. I could have gone back down to En-Gedi and other places. But instead, he goes to the land of the Philistines, and he figures that someday Saul will get him, or Saul will just despair of even seeking to find him. So, David had forgotten his own words in Psalm 27, where he said, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid?" Sometimes we can boast such confidence in God, and then the next day we can blow it so drastically. David was just like you and I. And so David arose, and he passed over with 600 men, verse 2, that were with him, unto Achish, the son of Maacah, king of Gath. So Achish was this king of this area of the Philistines, known as Gath. Now, this is the second time that David has gone to Gath, to Achish. The first time David went to the same area was in chapter 21. And when he got to the king of Gath and the Philistines were standing around looking at David, they said, "Isn't this David, the one that they sing about in Israel? It's on the top 10 of the charts on the radios in Israel, that popular tune. I don't know how the tune went, but it was something like, David has killed his thousands, or Saul has killed his thousands, but David has killed his 10,000s. And of course, those were mostly Philistines. And here he is among them. And David went, gulp. He says, think fast, think fast. And so he started feigning insanity. He let spit dribble down into his beard and started slobbering all over himself, started grabbling on the wall. And King Achish said, what do I need this flipped out insane weirdo for? Get rid of him. And so David was taken out of his presence, and when he got out of his presence, he started rejoicing and praising God. Now he comes back. I don't know what Achish must have thought, that he was healed or something. I don't know. But he comes back and he's in the area of the Philistines called Gath. And David dwelt, verse 3, with Achish at Gath, and he and his men, every man with his household, every man David with his two wives, Ahinoam and Abigail, the Carmelitess, Nabal's wife, actually was Nabal's wife, he died. And in verse 4, it was told Saul that David was fled to Gath, and he sought no more again for him. Saul's going to have other concerns right now, the Philistines coming against him rather than worrying about David. Now it said that David, verse 5, said unto Achish, if I have now found grace in thine eyes, let them give me a place to which town in the country, that I may dwell there, for why should thy servant dwell in the royal city with you? Then Achish gave him Ziklag that day, whereof Ziklag pertaineth unto the kings of Judah until this day. Ziklag was about 12 miles north of Beersheba, which was down in the southern part of the nation, down around Judah. And so it says in verse 7 that at that time David dwelt in the country of the Philistines. It was 1 full year and 4 months. And David and his men went up and invaded the Geshurites and the Gerzrites and the Malachites and the Uptites and the Adicites and all those other fellows. For these nations were of old inhabitants of the land which goeth unto Shur, even into the land of Egypt. Now, as I mentioned, David is kind of resorting to the arm of the flesh. He's falling away from really seeking God here and stuff. And what he's doing is exchanging trust for God. He's exchanging trust in God and the promises of God for the walls of Ziklag, for the protection that he can find in the enemy camps. Now, what's he doing here in verse 8 is he is raiding these northern cities that are on the Sinai Peninsula. He's living in Ziklag, nothing to do. So he gets his men together and starts raiding these areas that were Philistine cities in the northern area of the Sinai Peninsula. So David, in verse 9, smote the land and left neither man nor woman alive. He took away sheep and oxen and asses and camels and the apparel and returned, and he came back to Achish. Now Achish said unto him, where you been hanging out, David? That's a free paraphrase. He says, where have you made a road today, or where have you raided today? And David said, oh, against the south of Judah and against the south of the Jezreelites and against the south of the Kenites. Now, David was lying there. It's another reason why I say David isn't really doing what God wants him to do. David's not telling the truth. He wasn't raiding these cities, but he didn't want Achish to know that he was being a bad boy and raiding areas of the Philistines. And so David saved, verse 11, neither man nor woman alive to bring tidings to Gath, saying, lest they should tell on us, saying, so did David, and so will be his manner, all the while he dwelleth in the country of the Philistines. And so Achish believed David, saying, he hath made his people Israel utterly to abhor them. Therefore, he shall be my servant forever. So when David would come back from raiding Philistine cities, Achish would say, where you been raiding lately? And David would say, oh, southern cities of Judah, which were Israelitish cities. And Achish thought, well, good boy, good boy. You're building up this animosity, this hatred against your people. And all the time, he was raiding Philistine cities. He just made sure that no one lived so they could get back to Achish and let him know. He would kill even cats and dogs unless they went and barked or something, you know, and gave word away. And so David is trying to cover his sin again in the energy of the flesh. Now, this is where the things get hot for David. It said, it came to pass in verse 1 in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together to go to war and fight with Israel. And so Achish said unto David, know thou assuredly that thou shalt go out with me to battle, thou and all thy men. And David said, verse 2, unto Achish, surely thou shalt know what thy servant can do. And Achish said unto David, therefore will I make thee thy keeper, mine and of my head forever. Now what's happening here is that, as the text says, the Philistines are now going to war against Israel. And David is living with the Philistines. And so the Achish comes to David and he says, David, we're going to go fight Israel. And I want you to go and fight with us. So he's on the hot seat. What's he going to do? Is he going to say, no, I can't fight my own people. Oh, I don't want to do that. He's been telling the king, he's been raiding them. And so now he's kind of stuck in a place. Will he compromise? Will he fight against his own people? Is he going to try to save face in front of Achish? What's he going to do? You see what happens when you get in with the wrong crowd? Oh, I'm not going to get drunk with them tonight. Oh, I'm not going to smoke drugs. I'm just going to go and talk to them. They're my friends, you know. And then they start saying, oh, come on, just, you know, smoke one joint or just drink a few beers and do this. And then after a while, you just, oh, okay. And then you do it. Next thing you know, you've fallen into sin. They've pulled you right back into the world. Basically, David is going back into the world. He's walling it. So David tells Achish, all right, I'm with you. And then he even boasts. He says in verse 2, you can see what thy servant can do. David's saying, you watch me go out there and smoke those Israelites. I think that's pretty tragic. David's ready to go out and fight against his own people. Now, stopping here in verse 3, we have a kind of a long paraphrase in the story. And we have an interlude here where we go back. It's kind of like a meanwhile back at the ranch. We find out what's happening in the life of Saul. It says, now Samuel, we don't pick up the story till we get to chapter 29. But now Samuel was dead, verse 3. And all Israel lamented him and buried him in Ramah, even his own city. And Saul had put away those that had familiar spirits and wizards of the land. And the Philistines gathered themselves together, and they came and pitched in Shushim. And Saul gathered all Israel together, and he pitched in Gilboa, Mount Gilboa. And when Saul saw the host of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart was greatly trembling. And when Saul inquired of the Lord answered him not, neither by dreams, nor by Urim, nor by prophets. Then said Saul unto his servants, seek me a woman that hath a familiar spirit, that I may go and inquire of her. And his servants said unto him, behold, there is a woman that hath a familiar spirit at Endor. And Saul then disguised himself and put on raiment, and he went and two of them with him. And they came to the woman by night and said, I pray thee, divine unto us by the familiar spirit, and bring me up him whom I shall name unto thee. And the woman said unto him, behold, you know what Saul has done, and how he hath cut off all those who have familiar spirits and wizards out of the land. Wherefore then liest a snare unto me, or wherefore thou liest thou a snare for my life to cause me to die? And Saul swore to her by the Lord, saying, as the Lord liveth, there shall no punishment happen to thee for this thing. Then said the woman, okay, who do you want me to bring up for you? And he said, bring me up Samuel. And when the woman saw Samuel, she cried with a loud voice. And the woman spake to Saul, saying, why have you deceived me? For you're Saul. The king said unto her, don't be afraid, for what sayest thou? And the woman said unto Saul, I saw gods ascending out of the earth. Or I saw those that looked like divine beings. And he said unto her, what form is he of? And she said, an old man cometh up, and he is covered with a mantle. And Saul perceived that it was Samuel. He stooped with his face to the ground, and he bowed himself. And Samuel said unto Saul, why hast thou disquieted me to bring me up? And Saul answered, said, I am sore distressed, for the Philistines make war against me, and God is departed from me. How sad. And he answered me not, no more, neither by the prophets nor by dreams. Therefore I have called thee, that thou mayest make known unto me what I shall do. Then said Samuel, wherefore then dost thou ask of me, seeing the Lord is departed from thee and become thy enemy? I read all that because I wanted you to get the sweep of the story, and it goes on. But this is, of course, the final episode in the life of Saul. Second episode is his death on Mount Gilboa. We see how tragic is the end of the life of King Saul. The Lord has departed from him. The kingdom has been taken from him. Now he resorts to seeking a witch, one with a familiar spirit who can call up the dead and so he can communicate. Let's go back and draw a few things out what's happening here. In verse 3, it says that Saul had put to death all those that had familiar spirits and wizards. Now specifically, a familiar spirit is also called a medium. Mediums, I believe, are basically people who are either demon-possessed or they are in communication with demons. Today, when somebody supposedly calls up the dead, I believe that they are communicating with demons. It's a very, very, very foolish thing to tamper with and play around with. People think it's fun, they think it's cool, they think it's cute. Truth is, it's stupid. And the Old Testament Deuteronomy, God instructed the people to put wizards and mediums and people with familiar spirits to death. Now, Saul did that, then he resorted to seeking one. You see how inconsistent he's become? It's what sin does to a person's life. They just get irrational. But anyway, a medium was one who had a demon and they could call up demons. And then wizards, those who would perform magic and stuff like that, which was basically demonic activity. Basically, this is the same cup of tea or the same kind of stuff that Shirley MacLaine is involved in. If Shirley MacLaine lived in the Old Testament, she would have been put to death, stoned. I know the Lord loves her and would like to save her. She is doing so much to damn people's souls for eternity. She's now in a national campaign. She's touring the United States holding giant seminars basically on witchcraft and calling up the dead and finding out what your past lives are. And a lot of the involvement with hypnotizing, I believe, is dabbling into the area of demon spirits. Well, let's hypnotize this guy and find out who he was 300 years ago. Oh, he was 600 years ago, he was a Viking or something. And the demons are just totally having a heyday with these people, creating all these former lives. Demons have been around from time in the eternity. They can name people, places, things very accurately. Things that took place, historic events. When this person's in this hypnotic state, peeking, speaking through these people, I would never be hypnotized. I think it's a dangerous thing to do. Even if you're just doing it to overcome smoking or something, I think it's wrong. But I think that what Shirley MacLaine is doing in her TV program, Out on a Limb, somebody's just written a book, Out on a Broken Limb, is really a tragic thing. I fear for her soul. It's a damnable thing that she's involved in. The this idea that we've lived former lives. I did see one cartoon that I do remember that I thought was kind of funny. It was a little drawing of these two lizards sitting on a rock out in the desert. And one little lizard looked at the other one and he says, "I just had the strangest feeling that in a former life, I was Shirley MacLaine." She's on the upward scale, you know. Shirley MacLaine eventually will become a lizard. And so now they have no fear of death because they know they'll just go to another life. They'll become somebody else. The Bible says it's appointed unto men once to die. And after that, there's judgment. You don't die 6,000 times and continue to live. It's a ripoff of the devil is what it is. So Saul had put him to death, but then finally Saul, when he started to seek the Lord and the Lord wasn't answering, notice his fear of verse 5. Natural consequence of the Lord's leaving you, they're filled with fear. And he inquired of the Lord, but the Lord did not answer. He had no fear of God, and so his life was fear, filled with fear, turning now into Satan, which many people are doing today. You can go right down Highland Avenue and visit your palm reader and all these different things that are happening. And so they did have one witch at Endor, and so they went to her, and Saul disguised himself, and he went to the witch, and he says, "I want you to raise up somebody whom I will name you." And she says, "Who do you want?" He said, "Saul." And Saul was the great spiritual leader of the nation Israel, last of the great judges, the first of the great prophets. She sees Samuel, and then she realizes that this is King Saul. She says, "Why have you tried to deceive me?" And so forth. He says, don't worry, nothing happened. No. There's a lot of discussion over whether or not this woman actually was able to raise Samuel from the dead. Did this witch actually bring Samuel back from the dead? Because I believe today that when a person calls a dead person back, that it's not the person, that it's a demon. So the question is whether this person really had the ability to call Samuel back. It would seem as though it was Samuel. She was shocked to see him, and she knew that it was Saul. But to be honest with you, I don't know for sure whether or not it was Samuel that actually came back, or God let him come back, or if it was a demon, or what took place. Whatever took place, it seems as though this witch realized God was in the situation. God was using it, or it was out of her control. It wasn't your normal seance. This isn't your typical seance. She went home that night, and her husband said, "How'd it go today, honey?" She said, "Oh, it was just a weird day, you know. I had the weirdest situation. Somebody actually came back from the dead. This never happened to me." But anyway, she was freaked out. So Saul bows himself before Samuel, this great man, and Samuel says, "Why did you call me up? Why are you distressing me? If God has departed, verse 15, from you, and he's not answering you, then why are you trying to call me?" And Samuel says, then verse 16 said, "Wherefore then dost thou ask of me, seeing the Lord's departed from thee and become thine enemy?" Notice that. God's become your enemy. "And the Lord hath done to him as he spake by me," Samuel speaking to Saul, "for the Lord hath rent the kingdom out of your hand and given it to thy neighbor, even to David, because thou obeyest not the voice of the Lord, neither executest his fierce wrath upon Amalek. Therefore hath the Lord done this thing unto thee this day." Now, the heavy message that Samuel had for Saul: "Moreover, the Lord will also deliver Israel with thee to the hand of the Philistines. And tomorrow thou and thy sons will be with me. The Lord also shall deliver the host of Israel into the hand of the Philistines." And when Saul heard this, he fell immediately all along the earth, and he was sore afraid because of the words of Samuel. And there was no strength in him, for he had not eaten bread all day, nor all night. When Saul heard this, he just went wiped out. Now, basically, what Samuel's saying to Saul is that tomorrow you're a dead man. Good news. See, Saul was afraid to go to battle without knowing how it would go. He tried to seek the Lord, and the Lord didn't answer him because there was sin in his life, so he turned to a witch. And even through the witch now, Samuel comes back from the dead and speaks to Saul, and he says, Israel's going to be wiped out. And you and your sons are going to be with me tomorrow. Now, what does he mean, with me? Does that mean Saul went to heaven? I believe a possible explanation for this is that when everybody died in the Old Testament, before Jesus died and rose from the dead, that everybody went to one place, whether they were God-fearing or whether they were wicked. That one place in the Old Testament is called Sheol. In the New Testament, it's called Hades. But that one place was separated into two compartments. One side of it was a compartment known as Abraham's bosom. It was a place of comfort, also called paradise. The other side of Sheol was a place of torment. I believe this place is described in the New Testament in Luke chapter 16, where Jesus gives a story about a rich man and a poor man named Lazarus, where it says there that there was a certain rich man who fared sumptuously. He lived just flamboyantly, delicately, and all these riches and wealth. And then there was a poor man named Lazarus that sat at his gate daily begging for food. And he wanted even the crumbs that fell from the rich man's table, but he didn't give him any to eat. And Jesus said that the poor man died and was carried by the angels to Abraham's bosom. And the rich man died and in hell. He lifted up his eyes and he saw Abraham, or he saw Lazarus in Abraham's bosom, far off, being comforted. And so you have the two compartments. They both went to the same place. One a side of torment, one a side of comfort. And the rich man, seeing Lazarus on the other side comforted, he said, Father Abraham, send Lazarus that he may dip his finger in this water and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in this flame. And Abraham answered the rich man back and said, Son, remember that you in your lifetime had the good things and Lazarus the evil things. And now he is comforted and you're tormented. And besides that, Abraham says, there's this great gulf between us and you can't come to us and we can't go to you. Two compartments. And then the rich man said, Oh, Father Abraham, then just send Lazarus back so that he can go to my five brothers that they don't come to this horrible place. See, now he gets real evangelistic that he's in hell. He realizes that other people are headed the same place and he doesn't want them to come. You know, some people think that they're cool when they're going to hell and they're going to have a big party in hell with all their buddies. If I'm in hell, everybody that I hang out with will be there too. And, you know, we'll be drinking beer and asbestos cans and stuff. And we'll be having a blast and just partying. No, you won't. It's a place of utter darkness. Have you ever closed your eyes just as tight as you can close it? You can't see anything. It's just my hypothesis. I believe that's what hell will be like. Complete darkness for eternity. A place where the worm dieth not, where the fire is never quenched. It's got to be a place of torment, or he wouldn't have wanted Lazarus to dip a finger in water and cool his tongue. And then Abraham said, they have the law and the prophets. Let them hear them. He goes on and gives this big speech about, well, if someone rose from the dead, then they would believe. Then Abraham says they have the law and the prophets. They won't believe that. And that's enough. God's word goes out, and if we won't respond in faith, then God says, that's not, people want to see a miracle and some sign. God says, you have my word. Believe it or don't believe it. But anyway, this is what I believe Samuel meant when he said, today or tomorrow, you'll be with me. Except for there'll be a little gulf between us. And I'll be in a place of comfort, you'll be in a place of torment. That's just my theory, because I have a hard time believing that Saul went to heaven. Whether he did, I don't know. But anyway, Saul has fallen on his face and he hasn't eaten anything for a day or two. And when the woman came, verse 21, Saul saw that he was sore troubled. And he said unto him, Behold, thy handmaid hath obeyed thy voice, and I put my life in my hand, and I have hearkened unto thy words which thou spake unto me. Now therefore I pray thee, hearken also unto the voice of thy handmaid, and let me give you some morsel of bread before thee, and eat thou, that thou mayest have strength when thou goest thy way. But Saul refused, and he said, I will not eat. But his servants, together with the woman, compelled him, and he hearkened unto their voice. So he arose from the earth, and he sat upon the bed, and the woman had fat calf in the house, and she hasted, and she killed it. She took flour, she kneaded it. She did bake unleavened bread there. I remember this morning I was talking about the work a woman has to go through to feed her house. She didn't just get something frozen and pop it in the microwave. And she brought it before Saul and before his servants, and they did eat. And they rose up, and they went their way that night. Saul wasn't going to eat, and the woman, this witch, should have been wiped out, forced Saul with her servants to eat. Now, back to David. It says, the Philistines gathered together all their armies at Aphek. And Israel and the Israelites pitched by a fountain which is in Jezreel. And the lords of the Philistines, which is a reference to these other civil rulers or these other leaders of these different cities, they passed by hundreds and thousands. But David and his men passed by on the rear reward with Achish, means the end. It's kind of a hard word to say, the King James. Then said the princes of the Philistines, or the commanders of these different areas, what do these Hebrews here? And Achish said unto the princes of the Philistines, oh, is not this David, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel, which hath been with me these days or these years, and I have found no fault in him since he fell unto me on this day? But the princes of the Philistines were angry with Achish, and the princes of the Philistines said unto him, make these fellows to get out of here, return, that they may go not again to the place that thou hast appointed them, or that they may go, excuse me, to the place where thou hast appointed them, and let them not go with us to the battle, lest in the battle he be an adversary to us. For wherewith should he reconcile himself to his master? Should it not be with the heads of these men? Is not this David? Again, they heard the song on the radio too. That song whom they sang to one another in dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands, but David has slain his 10,000s. David's thinking, well, why did that song have to ever hit the charts? It's exposing him wherever he goes. Now, what is happening here is when everybody's getting ready in the Philistine group to go to fight the Israelites, they're grouping up, the commanders are coming, and the Philistine commanders from these other cities see David in their ranks. And they said, hey, what's this guy doing here? You know, you got to admit that if you were a Philistine going to fight an Israelite, and there was about 600 Israelites fighting next to you, you'd wonder, you know. How do we know that in the heat of the battle, they're not going to turn and start lopping off our heads? I don't think I trust these guys. Send them home. And Achish says, oh, this is David. He's a good guy. He's been hanging out a long time, smiting Israelite cities and stuff. Don't worry about him. He's cool. He's on our team. The lords of the Philistines said, no way. You send them home right now. We're not going to fight with these guys. They said, what better way does David have to reconcile back to Israel than to turn against us in the battle and take off our heads? And so, of course, Achish has to capitulate. He goes to David. He says, David, sorry, buddy. He says, I believe in you. I think you're a great guy. But the rest of these dudes don't want you fighting with us. So we're going to have to send you home. David kind of, you know, says, whoa, what's the problem here, you know? I can do it. Achish says, I know you can, but we're going to send you home anyway. I'll just paraphrase verse 6 down to the end of the chapter. So, David is in a tight spot, and God delivers him. Now you say, what do you mean David's in a tight spot? Let me clarify that a little more. David is marching with the enemies of God to fight God's people. Now, I wish I knew what was going on in David's mind. Was David going to go through with it? Could David have fought in his own people? Or was David all the time saying, oh God, get me out of this one. Lord, I don't want to fight. Lord, I don't want to do this. He sees himself being sucked down the tube. And he's just thinking, Lord, I don't want to do this. I don't want to sin in this way. I don't want to reproach your name. Lord, somehow cover for me. And David knew that if he told Achish, I won't fight with you, then it would arise suspicion in Achish's mind, and David would be in trouble there. So, I mean, he's in a pickle. He's like Peter warming himself by the enemy's fire. And a servant girl says, you're a Christian. I've seen you with Jesus. And Peter stops and says, what am I going to do? If I identify with Jesus, I might be arrested. If I say I don't know him, then I've sinned against the Lord. You know, you're in that pickle. It wouldn't have happened had Peter not followed afar off, warmed himself by the enemy's fire. If you're hanging out with the wrong kind of people, and you're being pressured to sin, don't blame God. You need to get out of there and find new company. You need to find a new place to hang out. Oh, the pressure's on and I just sinned. Well, you shouldn't have been there to begin with. So David's in this pickle, and what happens? God is gracious. And he steps in, intervenes, and delivers David. Now, if David did want to get out of the circumstance, I just kind of, with my imagination, put myself in David's place. And when Achish came to David and said, David, the lords of the Philistines don't want you to fight with us, David figured that he was going to play the scene a little farther along to make Achish think that he was really committed. And he kind of got uptight for a while. He says, what do you mean? I can fight, you know? But in his mind, he's thinking, thank you, Lord. And then after he got away from the presence of Achish, I'm sure David said, oh, thank you, Lord, for getting me out of that. Though he was trying to stay cool all the way until he got out. It's what you call wishy-washy. It's what you call flakiness. Even David vacillated. Now notice what happens in David's life. In chapter 30, it said that it came to pass that when David and his men finally went back because Achish caused them to return to Ziklag on the third day, that the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag and smitten Ziklag and burned it with fire and had taken the women captive that were therein, and says that they slew not any, neither great or small, but carried them away and went on their way. So David and his men came to the city, and behold, it was burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters were taken captive. And David and the people, verse 4, that were with him, lifted up their voice and wept till they had no more power to weep. You talk about being down. And then if that wasn't enough, David's two wives were taken captive, Ahinoam and Abigail. And then verse 6, David was greatly distressed, for now even the people spoke of stoning him, because the soul of all the people were grieved, every man for his sons and for his daughters. What did David do? David encouraged himself in the Lord his God. Oh, I love that verse. Just that last phrase. David encouraged himself in the Lord his God. That verse has been an encouragement to me personally for many, many years. When I've been down and discouraged and bummed out, felt like all is hopeless, I've reminded myself that David was in the same place, and David was able to turn to God and find encouragement. He didn't turn to the bottle. He didn't turn to drugs. He didn't commit suicide, go jump off a bridge. It says that David encouraged himself in God. This isn't some self-help psych up either. He didn't look in the mirror and say, get it together, David. Come on now. Pull yourself together. Slap himself. You can do it. Be a man. I believe David got away from the rest of the men and he fell on his face in the dirt and wept before God. He said, God, I can't go any lower. deliver me, help me, strengthen me. And it was at that point that God stepped in and began to minister to David's heart, encouragement, strength, power. You know, for the last several chapters, we've read nothing about David seeking God. Now we do. Why is David so spiritual all of a sudden? Because things aren't going smooth. Isn't it funny how spiritual we can get when things go wrong? Oh God, help me. God delivers you. Oh, thank you, Lord. Just really appreciate it. Now get back on the shelf, and next time I'm in trouble, I'll come get you again. A few months down the road, we're getting ourselves all tangled up again and all messed. Oh, God. Or it says, you called? If I was the Lord, I'd get so tired of that syndrome, I'd just say, help yourself. You know, there were some points in the nation Israel when they were crying out to God after turning to idolatry and going into bondage, and God spoke back to them and says, where are the gods you've been serving? Why do you turn to me? Why don't you worship your tiki god, your idol, your piece of stone, your stick? See if they can deliver you in your hour of need. People turn away from God and they make God their money. They make their money God. Their career. Workaholics, make all the money you can all you get. And then their child is mangled up in an auto accident. Guess what the first thing is they do? Run down to the money and with bank and withdraw their money. Start calling out to their Bank America. Run to the new home they just bought and bow before it and cry out, oh, new home, help me. You know what they do? They call out to God. When they get desperate and they get down and they know there's nowhere else to turn, that's when they turn to God. And then second thing they do is call the pastor. Never see him in church, never have time for God. God has no place in their life until calamity comes. Then they call the church and they call out on God. So God sometimes will allow these kind of circumstances to drive us to our knees. It's like the poem I've quoted so many times, it's not funny. I thank God for the bitter things. They've been a friend to grace. They've driven me from the path of ease to store in the secret place. I thank God in my life for the things that God has allowed to go wrong, that it forced me from my easy path to a place where I had to get on my knees and seek Him. Someone said, prayer works so good in a time of calamity. I wonder why we don't use it more often in a time of prosperity. It's a good question. And so David is as low as you can get. His entire city's burnt. His wife, his children, everything's been taken. He's wept till he has no more strength to weep. And then all his men say, let's stone David. Oh, thanks, guys. They want to stone him. You talk about getting down. And David turns and encourages himself in the Lord his God. But you know what? It's always darkest before the dawn. Do you know that 3 days from this point, 3 days from this point, David is going to be on his way to sit on the throne in Israel? The throne seemed as far from David as he could imagine. 3 days, David, and you're sitting on the throne in Judah. He didn't know that. Cheer up tonight. Maybe you think that life couldn't get any worse. And it's always darkest just before the dawn. Don't give up. Sometimes we give up just before it begins to dawn. And we miss out on a great blessing. And so David encouraged himself. Now, first thing David did, seek the Lord. David said unto Abiathar, the priest, Ahimelech's son, I pray you, verse 7, bring me hither the ephod. And Abiathar brought thither the ephod to David. And David inquired at the Lord, saying, shall I pursue after this troop, and shall I overtake them? And he answered and said, pursue. Thou shalt surely overtake them, and thou wilt recover all. Notice how God is answering David as he's seeking him now. And so David went, he and his 600 men, verse 9, with him, and he came to the brook Besor, where those that were left behind stayed. But David pursued, he and his 400 men, for 200 abode behind, which were so faint that they could not go over the brook Besor. And they found an Egyptian in the field, and they brought him to David, and they gave him bread and did eat, and they made him drink water. And they gave him a piece of a cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. And when he had eaten, his spirit came again to him, and he had eaten no bread nor drank any water for 3 days and three nights. And David said unto this young man, who was an Amalekite, he said unto him, to whom belongest thou, and whence art thou? And he said unto the young man, he's not Amalekite, he's an Egyptian. He's of Egypt, servant to an Amalekite. And he said, my master left me because 3 days ago I fell sick, and we made an invasion upon the south of the Canaanites and upon the coast that belongeth to Judah and upon the south of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. And David said unto him, can you bring me down to this company? And he said, swear unto me by God that thou wilt neither kill me nor deliver me to the hand of my master, and I will bring thee down to this company. And when he brought him down, behold, they were there spread abroad in all the earth, eating and drinking and dancing, because there was all the great spoil that they had. And they had taken out of the land of the Philistines and out of the land of Judah. Now, what had happened was, as David inquired of the Lord said, go ahead and pursue. Take off. So he took off with 600 men. And as they were pursuing these people who had raided Ziklag, 200 fellows got too tired to travel any farther. If I was with David, that's the group I'd be in. And so they said, you guys hang out here. And so the rest of the group split, continued to pursue them. And they found this Egyptian kid about ready to die. They gave him something to eat, gave him something to drink, revived him. David said, who are you? And he says, well, I'm an Egyptian. I was a servant to an Amalekite. And I've been hanging out with these guys, and we raided this place, we burned Ziklag with fire, and I got sick 3 days ago, so my master just left me here to die. And David said, can you bring me down to this company? He said, if you promise not to kill me or turn me over to my master. David says, you got a deal. So, I don't know how long it took, but it seems as though it only took a short time. This guy took him right to this camp. I kind of like the suspense here. This is cool. And I can picture David way off on a distant bluff, and it's twilight, it's evening. And David's checking these dudes down in the valley below, and his wives are down there, and his children. And he's got 400 guys with him that are bummed out too, because their wives and their children are down there. And these guys have ripped him off. Now, David's fighting crew are mean enough, let alone you burnt their city and taken their family. And so David's got this group. He's looking down on these guys and he says, get your swords on, fellas. We're going to get our families back. And so David took out after these guys, and David smote them from twilight even unto evening the next day, all night and all day until dark the next day. And there escaped not a man of them, except for 400 young men that jumped on their camels and split. These guys had Porsches waiting, and so they jumped into them and took off. That was a luxury vehicle at that time. And so David, I love it, verse 18, recovered all that Amalek, or the Amalekites, had carried away, and David rescued his two wives. And there was nothing lacking to them, neither small nor great, neither sons nor daughters, neither spoil nor anything that they had taken to them. David recovered all. And David took all the flocks and the herds that they had drove before the other cattle and said, "This is David's spoil." Now, it is interesting that you can kind of draw typology from this slave that was found, help him find these other guys. I believe this slave represents a sinner, if you want to get into typology here. It's kind of like a sinner left to die. David, our Jesus Christ, comes along, feeds him, revives his spirit. And he once was a slave to an Egyptian. And Egypt in the Bible is typical of the world. Amalek, or he was an Egyptian, which is typical of the world, and he was a slave to an Amalekite, and Amalek is the type of the flesh. So he lived in the world, but he was governed by his flesh. Ready to die, and then he comes along, and now, guess what? He's a servant to David. Saved and revived, and now he's no longer a slave to the world, but he's a servant to David, who is, in a sense, a type of Jesus Christ. He's eating and he's drinking. He's not eating and drinking here, but he was fed and revived, and now he's a servant of David. Now, it says in verse 21 that David came to the 200 men that were too tired to pursue. They were so faint that they could not follow David into the brook Besor, and so they went forth to meet David and met the people that were with him. And when David came near to the people, he saluted them. It says, then David answered all the wicked men and the men of Belial. Then answered all the wicked men who were men of Belial, those that were with David. See, not everybody with David were the greatest type guys. Of those that went with David and said, because they went not with us, we will not give them aught of the spoil that we have recovered, save every man his wife and his children, that they may lead them away and depart. Then David said, you shall not do so, my brethren. For that which the Lord hath given to us, whom hath preserved us, and hath delivered the company that came against us into our hand. For who will hearken unto you in this matter? But as his part is that goeth down to the battle, so shall his part be that tarrieth by the stuff. They shall part alike. And it was so that it came that day afterward that he made a statute and an ordinance for Israel unto this day. This is a key verse that I would mark in your Bible at the end of verse 24, where it says, But as his part is that goeth down to the battle, so shall his part be that tarrieth by the stuff. They shall part alike. When they came back from overcoming their enemies, the 400 guys that had gone and fought all day, all night, and they had all the spoil, when they got back to the 200 guys that were pooped out along the riverbank, he said, hey, David, we're not sharing the spoils with these guys. They got to sit here, had it made in the shade, and we had to follow and fight. It's not fair that we give them the spoils. We'll give them back their wives and their kids, and they can split. But we're not going to give them anything else. And David says, no. It's not the way it works. David said, those that stay by the stuff shall share equally in the spoils as those that went down to the battle. And it became an ordinance in Israel. See, it's the linguistics. You have to have the supports back at home. Though they weren't on the front lines, those that were staying back protecting the home base, they got to share equally in the spoils when they brought it back. Now, I believe there's a spiritual lesson in this. That's why I said it's important. Not everyone is called to leave the comforts of the United States or other places where they live and become a full-time missionary in a foreign country. Not everybody is called to go full-time in the ministry. Not everybody's called to get out on the streets and evangelize. Everybody's called to be a Billy Graham. But we are all called to be involved in furthering the kingdom and serving Christ. But we're called to different places, different positions. Now, some of us are called to go out and fight in the frontline battle. And they can't do that a lot of times unless we that are home are supporting them. Morally, spiritually through prayer, financially through giving. Now, I may never have won a person in New Guinea to Christ, But maybe I stay home and work in the United States and I give my money and I pray and I support a missionary. When we get to heaven, I'm going to share equally in the spoils of that person's ministry because I have been a part just as much as they who were out on the front lines doing the work of Christ. So you identify with a ministry and you support it. You're going to share equally in the spoils. That's why I believe, as far as your tithes and offering or your finances are given to a ministry, you need to give to a ministry that's producing. It's teaching, ministering, serving. It's doing something so that you can share equally in the spoils of that when you get to heaven. A lot of times the illustration is drawn of a minister's wife. Say Ruth Graham for an example. I believe when she gets to heaven, she'll share equally in the rewards of Billy Graham. She supports and she prays. She stays in the background. She shares equally in the spoils when they both get to heaven. It's that support base. And so we're supporting one another. And we're going to share equally in the spoils when we get to heaven. I think that's a glorious principle. But anyway, it says that when David came, verse 26, he sent the spoil unto the elders of Judah, even to his friend, saying, "Behold, here's presents to you, the spoil of the enemies of the Lord, to them which are in Bethel, to them which were in Ramoth and Jephthah," and it names the different cities. Then in verse 31, chapter 30, it says, "To them which were in Hebron, and to all the places where David himself," and I like this, says, "were wont to haunt." I like that in the King James. Where they were wont to haunt. Where they hung out and raided. Now what is David doing here in verse 26? David is sending the fruit of the battle back to Israel for the first time. Now whether he's politicking or not, I don't know. It seems as though he is. He's sending these gifts back and saying, these are some of the fruit of the battles of the Lord's. And, you know, just enjoy these gifts. What he's doing, he's endearing himself to the people of Judah. He's kind of winning his way back into the hearts of the people of Israel. He's been estranged from his nation because he's been running from Saul. Now he's sending gifts to them in Judah, and they're going, "Hey, where'd that new car come from? Oh, David gave us the money to buy it. David, who's David? Oh, he's this guy that Saul doesn't like, but he's a nice guy." Everybody's going, "Yeah, isn't David a great guy?" And so David's sending these gifts back. And he's kind of winning himself back to the people. Now, we're just going to read chapter 31 to conclude the book. It says, "When the Philistines fought against Israel," this is the final chapter in Saul's life, "that the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines." Now, this is meanwhile back at the ranch for Saul. The battle is started on Mount Gilboa. It says that the men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell down slain before Mount Gilboa. I remember when we were in Israel, and we drove by Mount Gilboa. That was one of the awesome places for me to go by. We didn't stop and get out, but driving by and seeing Gilboa on my left, I thought about this battle. And I could just picture it covered with Philistines, Israelites, Saul, Jonathan, and being slain there on Mount Gilboa. It's up in the northern part of Israel, down in the Jordan Rift, and it's up by the Valley of Jezreel, where the Battle of Armageddon will be fought. It's just something about that area that a lot of battles are fought. Mount Gilboa is about 1,600 feet above sea level. It's a pretty good sizable mount. And so the Philistines followed hard upon Saul and upon his sons. And really sad here, it says, the Philistines slew Jonathan and Abinadab and Melchishua, Saul's son. And so as Samuel predicted, as he was brought back from the witch, "Tomorrow you and your sons will be with me." And then it says, verse 3, that the battle waxed sore against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was sore wounded by the archers. Then said Saul unto his armor bearer, "Draw thy sword and thrust me through therewith, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and abuse me." He was afraid that they would actually, like Samson, take him and tease him and torture him. So his armor bearer would not, for he was sore afraid. Therefore Saul took a sword, and he fell upon it. Saul committed suicide. And when his armor-bearer Saul saw that Saul was dead, he fell likewise upon his sword, and he died with him. And Saul died and his three sons and his armor bearer and all his men that same day together. And when the men of Israel, verse 7, that were on the other side of the valley, that is on the eastern side of the Jordan River, they saw that the men of Israel fled and Saul and his sons were dead. They forsook the cities and fled, and the Philistines came and dwelt in them. This is over in the area of Gilboa, on the eastern side, though, on the Jordan. And it came to pass, verse 8, that on the next day the Philistines came to strip the slain, and they found Saul and his three sons fallen upon Mount Gilboa, and they cut off his head, they stripped off his armor, and they sent it to the land of the Philistines round about to publish it. So they put it in the mail and sent this guy's head around everybody. And they put his armor in the house of Ashtaroth, and they feasted upon his body, It's a nice mistake. Cannibalism. They fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan, which is one of their pagan temples. Ashtaroth was the female side of Baal. They had Baal, and Ashtaroth was like his girlfriend or whatever. And so when the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead heard that which the Philistines had done to Saul, and all the valiant men arose, and they marched all night, and they took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from off the wall of Bethshan. They came to Jabesh, and they burnt them there. It's an interesting reference to cremation. I may be wrong, but I think it's one of the only in the Bible. And in this case, it was Saul, backslidden, committed suicide. His body was already pretty much chopped up. So they cremated it. A lot of people ask me about cremation. Is it okay? Most of the burials, most of the situations in the Bible were burials, not cremations. But in this case, cremation. But I don't think it really matters. And so it says, they took their bones, verse 13, buried them under a tree at Jabesh, and fasted for 7 days. So we have the death of Saul, the sad and tragic conclusion of Saul's life. Saul is the man that could have been, should have been, but wasn't. It's possible to have a good beginning, but to have a tragic end. You know, let me just say this right now. It seems as though of late I have just been bombarded with Christians falling away from God. Just in the last few weeks, it just seems like everywhere I turn, I'm hearing about this person's backslidden, this person's love for God's grown cold, this person's not coming to church anymore, too busy. People that I have known for many years and that have had a good beginning, good foundation in the word, they're dropping like flies. And it's tragic. We need to get on our knees and pray that God, by His grace, will keep us humble, in love with Him, committed to Him and to His Word and to serving Him, and that God will help us to keep our priorities right. So easy to get lax and slack. Oh, I've heard that Bible study before. Oh, I'm bored with the Lord. Oh, I'd rather go water skiing. 1,000 things to occupy our time. But one day this life is going to be all over. The Lord shall return. And all those worldly pursuits that we thought were so important are going to be of no avail for the kingdom of God. It's possible to start good, but to end bad. The Bible does say that he that hath begun a good work in you will complete it unto the day of Jesus Christ. We need to keep our gaze upon him, our focus upon him. I don't want to end like King Saul, committing suicide. I want to live out for the Lord. I don't want to burn out. I don't want to rust out. I want to live out. Let's pray.